And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear a report about open water swimming from Anna Mateo. Later, John Russell brings us this week's Everyday Grammar Report. We end with another episode of The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Jonathan.
Scientists say the remains of a young lion found in Russia in 2018 are 28,000 years old and in excellent condition. They say the lion baby, or cub, may still hold some of its mother's milk inside it. The cub was a female cave lion. Researchers named her Sparta. Her remains were discovered in permanently frozen ground at the Simulik River in Russia's Yakutia area. The remains of another ancient cave lion had been found nearby in 2017. It was a male that researchers named Boris. The findings were part of a study published in the journal Quaternary. The study said the cubs were found 15 meters from each other. But the scientists said many generations separated them. The research showed that Boris lived around 43,448 years ago. Cave lions died out thousands of years ago. The two cubs, aged 1 to 2 months, were found by mammoth tusk collectors. Mammoths were large, hairy, prehistoric elephants with very long teeth or tusks. Two other lion cubs have also been found in the Yakutia area in recent years. Valery Plotnikov is one of the study's writers. He told Reuters that Sparta was so well preserved that it still had its fur, organs, and skeleton. The find itself is unique. There was not any other such find in Yakutia, he said. Plotnikov added that the scientists hope to find evidence of mother's milk inside Sparta in order to learn what cave lions ate. Similar finds in Russia's larger Siberian area have increased in recent years. Climate change is warming the Arctic faster than the rest of the world. That increase in temperature has melted the ground in some areas that were permanently frozen.
A 14-year-old California boy has become the youngest person to swim the entire 34-kilometer length of Lake Tahoe. The boy's name is James Savage. He completed the swim on August 1st. It took him 12 hours to cross the famous lake. Lake Tahoe is along the state line of California and Nevada. It is known for its natural beauty. Savage's swim across the lake started in South Lake Tahoe, California, and ended in the Nevada town of Incline Village. His effort was part of a swim event called the Lake Tahoe Triple Crown. It is called the Triple Crown because it is made up of three parts. That includes the true width and length of the lake, as well as an area called Viking's Holm. This is a crossing at the southern part of the lake. Before swimming the 34-kilometer length of the lake, Savage had already successfully completed the other two parts of the competition. Each of those is more than 16 kilometers long. Savage and his mother, Jillian, talked to a local newspaper about the event and how he prepared for it. They both agreed that the physical preparation was a lot easier than the mental preparation. It takes great mental endurance to complete such a long-distance swim. However, his mother said she knew that after the first mile, her son would succeed. Jillian Savage told the Tahoe Daily Tribune, "I had no doubts whatsoever. He has been swimming almost every day, 6-7 days a week, since he was 8. This was also not the first time he swam across Lake Tahoe. Last August, at age 13, Savage became the youngest to complete the 19-kilometer true width swim. It is also known as the Godfather Swim. That is because it starts on Tahoe's west shore, at a mansion that appears in the movie The Godfather Part 2. Jillian Savage said that swimming in open water is what her son prefers. Open water swimming takes place in natural bodies of water, such as lakes, rivers, and oceans. James said he enjoys swimming in pools, but they are pretty much all the same. In open water events and competitions, he said, you can swim in oceans, lakes, and you get to travel around. Jillian Savage said when her son started swimming in open water events, he told the family he wanted to swim from Alcatraz, the famous prison off the California coast, to the city of San Francisco. He was only 8 years old when he made that trip. She said, we let him do it, kind of hoping and thinking it would be a one and done. But as soon as her son got out of the water, he said he wanted to do it again. His latest swim was led by Captain Tom Reptile Linthicum of Lake Tahoe Marathon Swim Federation. The team also included an official observer and pace swimmer. A pace swimmer is an individual who swims alongside or near an open water swimmer. Jillian Savage rode a small boat alongside her son during his swim. The mom's biggest worry was that he might give up after a few hours if he got bored. She said that it takes many people to make the swim event possible, but in the end, it is really just him out there by himself. It is not like he can sit and talk to us when he gets bored, his mother said. His face is in the water, and so really, he is by himself. James said he is not sure what he wants to do next. His mom says he will likely set his goal high. She added that his swimming challenges keep getting more and more difficult. I'm kind of afraid to see what he wants to do next, she said. But whatever his next swimming goal is, his mother said she and his supporters will help him make it happen. I'm Ana Mateo.
Imagine you hear Americans discussing plans, activities, or events. You will likely hear statements such as, "I would like to," "I want to," or "I'll try to." We will explore the grammar behind such statements in today's Everyday Grammar. In this report, you will learn about shortened statements that use the word to. Let's begin with a few important terms and ideas. A phrase is a small group of words that work together to form a basic idea. Phrases typically make up a part of a clause. Clauses are groups of words that have a subject and a predicate, the part of the sentence that says something about the subject. In everyday speaking and writing, English speakers often shorten phrases that repeat information. These shortened forms often come after certain verbs. The term infinitive refers to the word to plus a verb, as in to go or to see. Infinitive phrases are groups of words that have an infinitive as well as other words, as in to come to an event. English speakers often shorten such phrases, particularly if they repeat information that has already been stated. The shortened form is the word to. Let's explore an example. Imagine you hear two people discussing an event.
You don't have to come to the event.
Well, I would like to.
The infinitive phrase is to come to the event. In the second statement, the word to is an example of a shortened form. It takes the place of a larger group of words. If the second speaker had said the entire sentence, it would have been this.
You don't have to come to the event.
Well, I would like to come to the event.
English speakers often shorten infinitive phrases after certain common verbs or verb forms, including would like, want, and try. Imagine you hear a boss asking a worker about a project. It might sound like this.
Will you finish the project today?
Yes, I'll try to.
If the worker's statement were not shortened, it would have been this.
Will you finish the project today?
Yes, I'll try to finish the project today.
We began this report with a question about statements such as, I would like to, or I want to, or I'll try to. While the examples in this report used the pronoun I, please note that English speakers use shortened forms with other pronouns, we, she, he, they, and so on. Also, please note that the word to has many other uses and meanings in English. It can be used to shorten a phrase, as described today, but it can have other uses, as part of a phrasal verb, for example. The next time you listen to English speakers, pay careful attention to the word to. Make note of how speakers use it to shorten phrases. Try to shorten infinitive phrases in your own speaking or writing. Over time, you will begin to shorten phrases much like an American. I'm John Russell.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1796, the new nation held its third presidential election. George Washington won the first two elections without opposition. But 1796 saw a change in American politics. That year, for the first time, there was more than one candidate for president. There was also more than one political party. The Federalists were led by former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and the Republicans were led by former Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was a Federalist. Most people expected him to win. He was well known throughout the country. He had campaigned for American independence from Britain. He had served as a diplomat in Europe and as the first American minister to Britain. He was George Washington's choice for vice president and had served in that position for both of Washington's terms. But unlike other Federalists, Adams was not loyal to Alexander Hamilton. So Hamilton worked against Adams. Hamilton tried to win support for his own candidate for president. His choice was another Federalist named Thomas Pinckney from South Carolina. At last, the day arrived for counting the votes of the electors. The Federalists were shocked by the results. 71 electors voted for John Adams. 68 voted for Thomas Jefferson. Only 60 voted for Hamilton's choice, Thomas Pinckney. Under the electoral system used at that time, the candidate with the most electoral votes became president. The candidate with the next largest number of votes became vice president. So America's second president would be John Adams, a Federalist, and his vice president would be Thomas Jefferson, a Republican. Jefferson had resigned from public service a few years earlier, but he decided to accept his election as vice president. He wrote to his friend James Madison that he was willing to serve under Adams. Jefferson said he believed Adams was the only man who could stop Alexander Hamilton from becoming president in the next election in 1800. To Adams himself, Jefferson wrote that he valued their long friendship and hoped it would continue. Republican newspapers carried articles that were friendly to Federalist John Adams, the first time they had done so. Adams and Jefferson took office in March 1797. However, some Federalists believed their party's power had come to an end. Adams was a Federalist, but as we said, he was not loyal to the party's leader, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, sitting in his law office in New York City, did not lose hope. He knew he still controlled the top Federalist leaders in Congress. More than that, he believed he knew how to control John Adams. The new president made Hamilton's job easy. Adams kept George Washington's top advisors. The three men who had served in Washington's cabinet would now advise President Adams. Washington had appointed them at Hamilton's request, and they always did what Hamilton told them to do. Historians still cannot explain why John Adams, a man who did not like or trust Alexander Hamilton, kept the three cabinet secretaries. If the secretaries had been men of great ability, then that might be an explanation. But they were not. One was a secretary of state who knew very little about foreign relations. The second was a secretary of the treasury who knew even less about finance. And the third was a secretary of war who knew nothing about military matters and defense. Adams may have kept these men as an act of party unity, or he may have kept them because he could not get anyone else. Whatever his reason, the decision was politically costly for Adams. The three cabinet secretaries worked together against him. President Adams would tell his cabinet secretaries what he wanted. Then they would secretly go to Alexander Hamilton for their orders. In the end, these secret activities helped destroy the Federalist Party. They also made the administration of John Adams one of the most important periods in the political history of the United States. John Adams was born in the village of Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1735. He wanted to be a farmer, but he was sent to Harvard College to study to be a clergyman. He had no interest in that career and became a lawyer instead. In the years before the American Revolution, John Adams wrote articles about the injustice of British rule. He also became a delegate to the First Continental Congress. He urged the Congress to appoint George Washington as commander-in-chief of the colonial armies. He argued for the creation of a navy, and he helped develop the resolutions declaring America's independence.
We think of George Washington in his famous farewell address, urging Americans to give their loyalty to the United States, to further its interest and not to be loyal to some foreign country. And that was what Adams believed as well.
John Furling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He has written many books about America's founders, including John Adams. He says Adams wanted Americans to be able to govern themselves through their representatives.
Adams was opposed to monarchies, and he was opposed to rule by hereditary nobility.
Adams spent most of the Revolutionary War years in Europe. He helped win Dutch recognition of the new American nation. He also negotiated a loan from the Dutch government, as well as a treaty of friendship and commerce. After the Americans defeated British forces, he helped negotiate the peace treaty between the two countries. Then he served as the first American minister to Britain. Adams was extremely intelligent and was a thoughtful, lively writer. However, John Furling says, Adams often acted very coldly and said little, or he easily became angry.
If you thought of adjectives to describe Adams, certainly you would think of words like captious, contrary, gruff, egotistical, short-tempered, whatever.
But he says many people liked Adams after they got to know him.
He was certainly an excellent conversationalist, and he was filled with ideas, and he wasn't a vindictive person. He seemed to be a very honest person.
His best friend was probably his wife, Abigail. They were married for almost 60 years. Joseph Ellis, a history professor at Mount Holyoke College, wrote a book about their relationship.
They are the first power couple in American history. She has greater influence on policy than any first lady up until perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt.
Joseph Ellis says Abigail Adams did not see herself mainly as a hostess, even though she did lead social events. Instead, he says, the Adamses were a diplomatic team. Another of John Adams' supporters was Thomas Jefferson. This was strange. Jefferson's political philosophy was opposed to everything Adams represented. And the two men did argue, but they were also friends. For the last years of their lives, Adams and Jefferson wrote letters to each other about their memories and about the future of the country. Perhaps Jefferson liked Adams because he respected him for his intelligence. Perhaps he never forgot that Adams had fought hard for American independence. Adams had given many years of his life to the young nation. However, some people just did not like John Adams, but they knew they needed to work with him. Federalist leaders especially appealed to Adams' weaknesses when they wanted his support. For example, they knew Adams was jealous of George Washington. Sometimes, if Adams knew Washington's opinion on a subject, he would purposely offer a different opinion. Yet Washington, like Jefferson, respected Adams. He felt the new nation needed Adams' skills. And John Furling says Adams also respected George Washington, even though he thought Washington was not always fair to him. Adams' last public appearance was before cadets from the United States Military Academy at West Point. He was a very old man by then. Someone had to help him walk. And, says historian John Furling, Adams could not say more than a few sentences.
But what he did in that speech was he exhorted those would-be officers to model themselves on George Washington. And called Washington a great man.
Adams' personal weaknesses caused other troubles during his presidency. He belonged to the Federalist Party, but he did not want to become involved in party arguments. And he did not want to make all the compromises necessary in the world of politics. So other Federalists often worked against him. Adams won the presidency in 1796, but his term would be difficult. His own party, the Federalists, did not trust him, and he did not have the support of the general public. The people knew he believed that men of money and position should govern America. Even so, Adams did not expect the job of president to be easy. In politics, he said, a man must always walk on broken glass and red-hot iron. It is not easy to do this when you're not wearing shoes, but some men must do it. There are many dangerous things that have to be done for our country in these dangerous times. If nobody else will do them, he said, he will.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.